I've always seen Richard Cordery as a classical actor. He's spent a lot of time with the RSC. He was involved in a large number of history plays during some tremendous seasons. He was a hilarious Malvolio who unforgettably turned up in yellow biker's leathers. And he's also been a distinguished Polonius. All of a sudden, he's remaking himself as the star, along with Sean Thomas and a bunch of teenagers, in Spring Awakening, which is a teen rock stroke punk musical. I imagine it's great fun to do. And at the moment, we are in the number one dressing room at the Novello Theatre on the day before it has its West End opening. So, Richard, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Delighted to be here and talking to you all.
So where did Spring Awakening come from? As I said, you have done modern work, but you're best known, I think, as a classical actor. And all of a sudden, you're appearing in Spring Awakening.
Out of the blue. I was at the Almeida in a play called Waste, and I got a call from my agent's assistant asking me if I would be interested in meeting the directors. And I said, you know, my first question was, a musical, do I have to sing and dance? And she said, I don't know. And I said, well, find out before I waste the bus fare and waste their time. And she came back and said, no singing, no dancing, I'll send you the script. And he was coming over from New York, and I sort of ambled along, not really knowing quite what it was about. I knew nothing about the huge buzz that there had been on Broadway. I was discovered that when I came to the meeting. And I met them, and I was absolutely thrilled with what they call themselves, the creatives.
Right.
The team. And there are about 45 people in this long, long table. And I said that I was knocked out by the mixture in the play of the original Wedekind and this, as you've just called it, punk. You know, there's a, I'm not sure, I'm going to say it anyway, but there's a wonderful couplet which as a classical actress struck me, which was, he rhymes, there's a time when you're fucked with self-destruct.
And yes, I
just
I
thought, what a joyful rhyme that was. And we talked about the process that they had gone through to get to where the production was. And I still didn't know much about it. I hadn't seen anything on YouTube, whatever. When they asked me to do it, I sort of agreed begrudgingly, but only because I booked a holiday for my wife in Antigua. And I thought the rehearsals would start way after that, but it was the next day or something ghastly. And so I lost the holiday. Almost lost Mrs. Cordery too.
Oh dear, that doesn't sound good. But what you did find was a completely new kind of concept of ensemble, because I think looking through, I said in one of my reviews from The Lyric, and I need to be careful here because you might hit me, but that there's basically 50 years of acting experience on the stage amongst the 17 people, and Sean Thomas and Richard Cordery had the whole of the 50 years. So you're basically with a bunch of people who are maybe semi-trained, maybe fully trained, all teenagers, I think, and virtually none of them, certainly none professional musicals, many of them haven't done any professional work. No. What's going on?
Well, I mean, that was one of the things which gave us pause, I'm sure, both Shana and I, because when you work with somebody who's never done anything before, there is a possibility always that they're going to be all over the place. Sean and I promise you that we entered a rehearsal room which was probably the most disciplined rehearsal room we have ever been in, where every single person in that room, both the actors and I call them actors, they're singers and dancers, as well, and the people who do what they call the swings, the replacement parts, were at all times totally focused. Now, one of the reasons they were like one of the reasons they brought that high degree of professionalism to their work was because they had been through, many of them, a process of auditioning over a year and been weeded down from 3,000 right down to the 12 or whatever that they were. And so they were encouraged all the way through to display professionalism. They always knew their lines, they always knew their moves, thank God, they also knew my lines and my moves and were able at all times to say, no, Richard, you stand a little bit further to the left. And because they'd lived with the play, for most of them, for such a long time, they had a working knowledge of a production that I had no idea. I didn't understand what the director was attempting to do. He's worked with it for 9 years since its inception as a sort of as a one-off platform piece, and was unaware of quite how ignorant I was about what they were trying to do. And so when I would suggest, can we do this or can we do that, he would blench and politely try and find words to say no, but didn't particularly want to. It all changed when we came to the lyric, and I sat out in the technical rehearsal and watched a section of it, and suddenly went, my God, this is astonishing. You're simply bombarded with, obviously, the beautiful noises that these wonderful students, or kids, children, whatever we call them. I call them children, but I call them the children in an affectionate way. The wonderful noise that they make and the wonderful choreography, which I think is sensational choreography, really fantastic. But then you also have lighting and I suppose we should call it Brechtian approach to the scene, so that scenes begin and end. Actors suddenly become characters and then stop again in a breathtakingly bold way. And then I was also aware, watching it, how things like hand microphones, which the kids carry around a lot, suddenly disappear, and you go, where did that go? And you realise that, as some sort of sleight of hand, the director has taken your attention to one place while the girls all slip the microphones underneath the edge of the stage. And when I mentioned this to the director and said how breathtaking I thought it was, he said, the designer came up with that. She said, let me build out a lip. So we can't put those microphones back in the girls' frocks and things. And you just go, this has been thought through like some sort of exquisite puzzle. And the end result, I think, is just every night it baffles me and delights me when I watch it.
But despite the rigidity and discipline, it's such fun.
the rigidity and the discipline almost broke my spirit. It really did, because as an actor, you come into the rehearsal room and you want to bring something, obviously, and that you think that's why you've been employed. And it was quite clear early on that whatever I was going to bring must not go over the edge or beyond this line or past this volume. And why are you holding the stick in your left hand? It should be in the right. And where's her apron? She has to have an apron on at this point. You think, come on, we're still staggering around trying to learn the damn thing. Afterwards, you realise why. They have arrived at this through a sort of theatrical distillation, and the last thing they need is Richard Cordery coming in going, I've got a better idea. So it was very rigid. It's much, now that we're playing it, it's much easier to play, and there is a freedom within it, but you now know what the limits are, and you simply have to observe those borders, because of the way the whole thing pans out.
And is it as much fun to do as it looks? You play, I don't know how many parts, you play lots and lots. I'm going to be careful how I express this. You basically play all the old people, or the older people. I don't know if people know the story. It's broadly, it's about literally a bunch of school children and about their spring or sexual awakening. It's tragic, it's funny, it's everything. What's it like actually to be in the midst of all of that and changing hats and changing clothes and changing roles on a constant basis?
Well, there are two aspects to it. One is your own involvement, which is you have to be pretty much on the ball, because any moment now there's going to be a drum roll and a tish and a light comes on and you've got to be standing up facing in a certain direction. But you kind of get used to that discipline. But more excitingly, I was sitting opposite Sian. Sian and I sit on stage for virtually the entire play when we're not acting. And I turned to her last night opposite me during Touch Me. And it makes me weep even now. I had tears rolling down my face because of the sheer beauty of listening to youngsters. And as you say quite rightly, they're very young, very inexperienced, but the open-throated, naive beauty of their just... They're singing about a situation which is, let's be absolutely honest, it's all of our situation at some stage or another. We all went through it. We all dealt with it or are dealing with it in our own ways to the best of our abilities. But these kids, there was a girl came the other day to the rehearsal from Aunt's Ed, and I said, do you know about it? She said, I've seen it three times. And I said, good Lord, really? And you still come to the rehearsal? And she said, yes, this play speaks to me in a way that no play has ever done. And I thought, well, that's probably the same for me, because it speaks to me in that sort of way too. It's a very moving piece to sit and observe as part of.
And what about the West End at the moment? This is launching into, well, New York, when I was over there, half of Broadway shows were closing in January and February. In London, everything seems to be pretty much healthy, booming. Priscilla has just opened with a budget that looked like about £1 billion, £1 million on a bus, etc. Your budget is probably rather lower than that, I would guess. Though maybe your salary takes it up to there, but broadly that's going to be rather lower. What do you think about the West End? Do you think there's a space for spring opening forever, for a couple of years?
Oh gosh, you know, you're talking to an actor, and actors are superstitious. So, of course, you know, I'm now going to touch wood and anything else I can touch. And you know the old saying about bread and circuses, the moment that the that things get really tight, people go to the theatre.
Yeah.
Partly because you can see a DVD or a movie, and it can be a personal thing, but if you go to the theatre, 1,200 people go as disparate individuals, and they end up very, very soon being an homogenous group, which feeds them, which gives them a sort of, it gives them something that, you know, money can't really buy, that feeling of shared experience. I don't know whether you were at the Lyric in the last week at the Lyric, but it's a much smaller theatre. But even then, we just had the most astonishing response. The most, you know, just to see an entire theatre leap to its feet, cheering at the end, says that something is happening in this play which makes people go out in the streets feeling better. And when do you really need to feel better, but at a time like this? Now, as for the West End in general, I don't know. I had a friend who was playing in Oliver, came for a drink last night in the dressing room, and he was saying things are absolutely fine in Oliver. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I did see the reports on Broadway of show after show after show closing. I don't know, and fingers crossed. I mean, I'm very happy doing this, so I'll stay with it for a long time.
Let's go back to early days. How did you end up in theatre to start with? Was it something you knew from when you were 3 years old you were going to do? Was it a late decision?
Yes, I suffered as a little boy from a terrible stammer, and I was also quite sickly, and I was in boarding school in Africa, and I would spend my time reading those encyclopedias which told you how plays were made, you know, backstage and things, and it really kind of, for some reason, the book always opened to that page again. And the English teacher, rather unpleasant fellow, wrote a play for the, it was a prep school. And I went to him when I got better and said, could I be in the play? And he said, of course you can't, you can't speak properly. And I put the disappointment behind me, but the real disappointment was when the play was actually on, I was back in sick bay for some another reason, a spider bite or something, you know, ghastly. So I missed the bloody play as well. But I knew then, I was seven, I knew then that there was something about this thing that really affected me more than anything. My first professional engagement with it was when I was 11, when I don't come from a theatrical family, and I had asked my mother and father to come and see me in a play. And my father could think of nothing worse, so he gave me half a crown instead. And I figured that was the beginning of my professional engagement. But then I met a man at school in England who said to me, have you ever thought of going to RADA? And I didn't know what RADA was. I was 12 or 13. And then I became obsessed with that. That was what I wanted to do. So I went to university first, because my parents insisted. Still determined to knock it out of me. And then I went on to RADA. And I knew, when I got to RADA, a lot of actors at RADA were kind of treating it as if it was university, that sort of thing. It's great to be here, honestly. I just used to walk around touching the walls, realizing that O'Toole and Finney and Diana Rigg and people they had been here. And I'm still a bit like that. I'm still a bit like that at the Novello Theatre, touching things, realizing who's been here. But it's always just been one of those. I mean, I'm very fortunate in that. It's always been something I really knew I wanted to do, and nothing that came between me and it seemed very important, you know. And I've got two children, and I was very keen on saying to them, look around and find what you really want to do. Don't do what you think you ought to do, because there's nothing like going to work because you really want to, not because you have to.
That sounds great. And once you came out of RADA, were you one of those lucky people who has been constantly in work? Did you ever have odd days or weeks where you weren't sure what you were doing next?
Well, a couple of things. I did King Lear at RADA, which is an odd play for a very thin young boy to be asked to do. And a director from the Redgrave Theatre, now abominably closed, that theatre in Farnham, disgraceful. But a director there, the artistic director, asked me to come and meet him, because he'd seen the play. And he offered me an equity card, which was what everybody needed in those days. And I said, oh, yes, please. And he said, oh, no, don't make an instant decision, Richard. Go away and think about it. And I said, what's to think about? And he said, oh, this was on Friday. Ring me on Monday and let me know. And I spent the worst weekend of my life in case he changed his mind. And I woke up on Monday morning. I thought, I can't call him at 7:15. I should wait. Anyway, from there, several other people had seen me at RADA. Mike Attenborough had seen me there, and he asked me to come up to Leeds. And then, in those days, casting directors would come out to the things, and I got a television series doing The Life of Shakespeare, Will Shakespeare, John Mortimer and Peter Wood directing it. And things were going swimmingly. And then it stops, as it always does. You think this is really... And I think I spent 6 months without any work at all. And that was the only time, touch wood, that I've been out of work. It was just a complete nightmare. You think, where is the next job going to come from? But from then on, as I've got older, I've got sort of more comfortable about, you know, certain kind of roles they have. It was very difficult when I was young because I was so tall. I still am tall, but I was tall and thin. And if I played a policeman, people would think, this must be a very important policeman. and that they couldn't really give me a couple of lines, you know what I mean? But no, I've been very fortunate for them. And I always had this dream. Like, I had a dream about RADA. I had a dream to be at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And that happened by chance. I mean, I went first when I was 30, I suppose, and it didn't really work. But then I went back again with Mike Attenborough. He asked me to go back and do The Friar. No, Edward Bond asked me to do something. His new play, The Company of Men. And I sort of stayed on. I mean, you know, if you know what the RSC does, it just signs you to a contract. Yeah. And then at the end of the season or whatever, it looks around and asks certain actors to stay on and certain actors not to. And I was always, obviously, very enthusiastic. And so they asked me to stay on. And on and on and on and on. And I stayed, I think, for about 10 years. And I only left in May of last year when we finished the histories.
The RSC is always an interesting decision for an actor because you're closing off so many other opportunities while getting the most fantastic opportunity. And to talk to a lot of actors who maybe like the idea of doing it for a couple of years, two or three years, some who would rather get loads of money in film, TV, whatever, you clearly decided that the stage and the RSC-style stage was for you.
Yes, I've always... I mean, when you said at the beginning, I hope partly... jokingly, that I'm a classical actor, but I've always loved doing Shakespeare and Jonson and even modern classical plays, and I've always found the company concept really exciting. It culminated for me in the happiest 3 years creatively that I've ever been involved in, where we had the well-known Histories Ensemble, which is now, unfortunately, had to be... It has disintegrated again. There's something rather wonderful about coming into work with a family, even a big family of 35 actors and 20 other support people, because you're in an environment where you feel secure and you can therefore do braver and braver stuff. And... the financial thing that people often talk about, I can now tell you, is bollocks. I'll tell you for why. Because I stopped in May and I decided I would do some television again, because I was doing a lot of television before I went to the RSC. And unless you're doing the sort of long-running television stuff that I was doing, if you do one-offs, like I've done some things for sitcoms, which are best left unmentioned. A, the money is poor, really poor. The work is very, very unexciting. But the gaps between the 2 weeks before you film and the week after means that the money that you get for it has to be spread out over those 4 weeks. Well, you work out what you're getting at the RSC, and all right, you're not getting those big lumps from adverts or telly or small films and things, but you, the RSC is not badly paid, I found. And I was talking to somebody the other night about precisely this thing. They look after you very, very well from that point of view. Of course we could always get more. But if you know what actors are getting down at Bristol or, Salisbury, then it's horrible what's up. Also, let's be honest, I'm not saying actors across the board, because I was being paid because I've been there so long, the optimum salary. And there are many people who aren't being paid, and for them it's perhaps not. But from my point of view, I didn't find it financially crippling. And I did a film with Polyakov just before Christmas, and a week's filming, and you look at the money for that, and you think, I thought film paid you really, really, really well. But it doesn't actually pay, not when you take all the bits before and the bits afterwards, going for a costume fitting and all that stuff, add all that together, it isn't that much better. And indeed, my agent, who's now no longer an agent, told me 2 or 3 years ago, she was used to be in Doctor Who, and she was an actress, and she said that she's now booking clients for money that she was being offered 20 years ago on television. So television money is really going down.
I was about to say, I find that incredibly encouraging, because it means we'll be able to see wonderful actors on stage a lot more, and perhaps that's an unfair thing to say. Richard Cordery, you are a wonderful actor who I'm looking forward to seeing on stage tomorrow night, and I probably won't see you for years to come, so I won't come back to Spring Awakening for a bit. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, that's a delight, and it's always nice to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming.